This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Elizabeth Cotton is a historic figure in the world of blues and folk guitar, and she has her roots right here in Carrboro, North Carolina. At only 12 years old, Elizabeth Cotton wrote the song Freight Train.
When I die, Lord, bury me deep, way down on old Chestnut Street, so I can hear old number nine as she comes rolling by.
Well, this weekend, the town of Carrboro will dedicate a historic marker to the life and legacy of Elizabeth Cotton. Glenn Hinson's a professor of anthropology and folklore at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and joins us now. Welcome back, Glenn. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
So old number nine was rolling right past her house on Lloyd Street, I guess, huh?
It indeed was, in a situation where classically she was on the other side of the tracks. Mm.
And it wasn't even Carrboro at the time.
Right, right.
So tell us about that time in Carrboro and what it was like for her and her family on her side of the tracks.
You know, Miss Cotton grew up in a time when African Americans were in the midst of Jim Crow. She grew up in the early 1890s, and so right in the harshest period of Southern oppression here. It meant that growing up, there were very few job opportunities for them. Her mom did domestic service, and she did too. In fact, she was doing domestic work with her mom probably by the time she was 8 or 9 years old, which is fairly telling when you figure that domestic work in Carrboro, most of that was for the white workers who worked in the cotton mills there. So factory workers who might themselves be earning $4 for a 70-hour week, and African Americans are then working, doing domestic work for these white families. So it gives you a sense of where financially and economically she came up.
So what about music? It is unusual, is it not, or was it, for young women to be playing the guitar and writing songs at the age of 12? How common was that?
You know, what we don't know because of the historical record is how many women were playing in this time. We know there were a lot. It's that they didn't get recorded. Because when young girls became young teenagers and when those teenagers became older, and often got married, it was considered inappropriate for young women to be playing out. And so it was the men that tended to dominate the house party scene, and women didn't get the attention. So we know in this area, we know that there were a lot of women who were playing. You talk to musicians and they will say, oh yes, I had six sisters and every one of them played guitar. But then you look at the historical record and think, how many of those women were recorded? And the answer is almost none.
And so how is it that Elizabeth Cotton came to be recorded?
By circumstance. Miss Cotton led a long life before she was recorded, and what she ended up doing in her mid to late 50s was working domestic service in Washington, D.C., the path she had followed for much of her life. But she happened to be working in domestic service for the Seeger family. And it was the Seegers, Mike Seeger, his sister Peggy Seeger, who actually heard her one afternoon playing the guitar in a back room. Mike says that he walked back and saw her there, and her first response was immediately apologetic, you know, immediately deferential. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to play someone's guitar. I just wanted to see it, etc. And he was taken by the mastery of her music, and she was busy attending to the racial politics of the day.
But now, these Seegers would also be kin to Pete Seeger, who would so did they bring her to Pete's attention? Is that how this happened, or did they take her to the studio themselves?
It was the latter, because these Seegers, it was the father who was the Seeger. Mike was the half-brother of Pete Seeger. Pete was on doing other things by that point. But Mike Seeger was very, you know, as a young man, he got active with the New Lost City Ramblers. He was very much a part of the folk scene. And it was actually Mike Seeger who began recording her in the house and produced the first album of hers for Folkways Records. It was largely recordings he made on one of the family tape recorders.
And of course, this is part of this folk revival of the late 50s, early 60s, where white folk are coming to understand rural music and much of that African-American music as well, right?
It's precisely the case. And she became one of those figures, African-American, elder, lots of guitar mastery. And for her, this very gentle spirit, which of course allowed folks to adopt, to embrace her music without having to think critically about from whence it came and the messages that it held.
Well, tell us about that song, because the song she wrote, Freight Train, the one she's best known for, is in fact a kind of adaptation of another song.
Yes.
It's
not a song that she wrote, honestly. In this area, there was a song called Way Down in Georgia on a Hog. And the term on a hog meant broke, hungry, penniless, and stuck. And it was referring to folks who had traveled down to Georgia looking for work and couldn't find their way back. In North Carolina, it was being sung a lot in the years of her childhood. And one of the verses in that song was a verse that talked about the freight train and included the same telling line that she adds, which is, "Please don't tell them the route I've gone," which has to do with, of course, being chased by the man. Now, when Miss Cotton recorded the song, she heard it, no doubt, as a child. She, in later years, recorded her version. The Way Down in Georgia part was gone. The freight train moved to the foreground. And the edge to that song, the edge that had governed that song, being a song about really the racial situation of the time, the edge was gone. The song was safe. And the song was really widely adopted by white America as this almost a feel-good anthem that allowed one to celebrate African-American artistry and almost innocence without having to address the social conditions from whence that artistry arose or to which it spoke.
So we are happy that Elizabeth Cotton is remembered, that her artistry was recorded and will be memorialized. And this is a lovely and charming song. But I guess you're suggesting that there is another song that we haven't remembered, that we haven't recorded, and whatever happened to that.
Right. And really, I think the thing when you look at someone like Miss Cotton, one wants to celebrate the remarkable achievements, celebrate the mastery in her guitar, celebrate the way that points to a whole hidden world of women's blues musicianship in African-American communities, all those things. But at the same time, one would hope that we would pay attention to the social conditions from which that music came and the conditions of Miss Cotton's life in particular and learn a lesson on that, use that as a lens to look at African-American communities in Carrboro today, for instance, and say, we can celebrate, but we should also look beyond the celebration to think about the role that we all play in refocusing away from the hard truths.
Is that anything that Elizabeth Cotton herself concerned herself with or talked about in any of the interviews that she might have done or any of the work that she did once she became known again?
You know, not that I've heard. But then she was interviewed primarily, almost exclusively, by adoring white fans. And so what we don't hear is that critical edge. Think about the racial politics of an African-American woman, elderly woman who grew up in this time period, who spent her life as a domestic servant and suddenly finds herself in this rather golden position of being revered as a musician. So whether she saw it fit to ever take that critical view publicly, I haven't heard it.
It's one of the interesting paradoxes about that revival, isn't it? On the one hand, probably if sort of middle-class white communities hadn't suddenly become aware of a whole body of folk art, that was about to go extinct, it would not have been preserved at all and we wouldn't know and there would be no celebration. On the other hand, there is this tendency then for a particularly middle-class audience to sanitize and whitewash some of the more difficult elements contained in that movement. Right.
Right. And I think it's very telling that the community at the time who was so enamored with the emergence of the blues, with listening to the blues and the folk revival, they weren't listening as much to the music that was speaking to the African-American community simultaneously. The blues by then had largely gone, except in a few areas. We're talking soul music, and we're talking music that was much more hard-hitting. And the folks who were interested in the folk revival weren't interested in listening to what young African Americans were listening to in the 60s. They wanted to know what young African Americans were listening to in the 30s.
Well, and in particular, the converse is interesting as well, because young African Americans themselves weren't particularly fond of this kind of country music, which they felt they had left. I mean, by and large, felt they had left behind, and that this didn't speak to them much at all. This is kind of historic old folks music.
Well, and it was music that it was hard to see because the edge wasn't there. The message wasn't so clear. It was hard to see those deeper layers that are in the music.
Well, I'm glad you're here to keep us honest. And also remember Elizabeth Cotton, a wonderful musician and part of our North Carolina heritage as well.
Indeed. And, you know, we must keep in mind she was masterful as a musician, as an artist, and represents a remarkable trajectory.
Glenn, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Glenn Henson, professor of anthropology and folklore at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This Saturday, the Arts Center in Carrboro will host a celebration of Elizabeth Cotton and unveil the marker. For more on that, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's Banned Book Week, and we celebrate, yes, celebrate, coming up on The State of Things. Stay tuned.